Good morning. It's 11 minutes before the hour. You're listening to NPR's Morning Edition over Raven Radio, KCAW in Sitka, where it's 33 degrees with light rain falling. Today is Wednesday, March 7th, 2012. I'm Robert Woolsey with Raven News. The U.S. Coast Guard yesterday dropped the charges against Lieutenant Lance Leone. The Sitka-based Coast Guard aviator was facing charges of negligent homicide and destruction of government property in connection with a 2010 helicopter crash. KCAW's Ed Ronco has more.
Leone's attorney said his client was ecstatic upon hearing the news that the charges have been dropped.
This is the beginning of a new chapter for him.
John Smith.
Probably one of the most difficult things he's going to have to do is to really be able to do that thing that he loves to do again. It's been quite a while since he has flown in or piloted an aircraft, and I'm hoping that he is going to be able to go to retraining soon, pass that retraining, and look forward to a new assignment in the Coast Guard, flying and rescuing people in accordance with the Coast Guard mission.
Leone was the co-pilot aboard Coast Guard Helicopter 6017 when it struck some wires between the mainland and an island near La Push, Washington, on July 7, 2010. The crash killed the chopper's pilot, Lieutenant Sean Kruger, along with aviation maintenance technicians Brett Banks and Adam Hoke. The crash was investigated by the Coast Guard, and Leone believed he had been cleared. He was on his way to train for a return to flight when the charges were announced in September. The charges came as a surprise to him and to many of his supporters in Sitka, where memorial signs still hang throughout the city's downtown. But retired Colonel John Farr, a former military attorney now in private practice in Anchorage, says he understands why Rear Admiral Thomas Ostebo, the commander of Coast Guard District 17 in Alaska, pursued the charges as far as he did.
For the sake of good order and discipline, I'm sure he needed to feel like he didn't leave any stone unturned.
Farr says the military operates on a culture of discipline and accountability. He said the decision not to head to trial didn't surprise him, but neither did the decision to investigate the charges in the first place.
The commander pursued the charges basically down a blind alley and reached the end of the road and said, well, okay, we really can't go any farther than that. There just isn't the proof there.
Ostebo's decision lines up with a recommendation made by Captain Andrew Norris, the officer who presided over a December hearing of the Coast Guard's evidence in the case. Norris did not say Leone was blameless in the flight, but he did say that the Coast Guard could not draw clear links between Leone's actions and the crash. In a statement, Ostebo said his decision was based on a review of the evidence from December's hearing and that Leone's actions do not merit a court-martial. Ostebo said that Coast Guard operations are inherently dangerous and that, quote, the deaths of three Coast Guardsmen and the circumstances warranted the fullest investigation into the charges against Leone. Still, Farr says there are administrative sanctions that could still apply, such as a letter of reprimand. That would make it very difficult for Leone to get back into the cockpit.
Of course, bear in mind that the Coast Guard of 2012 is something that could be different than the Army that I was in years ago. So things do change, policies change, but from what I know about the military, this put him in a hole, and it may not be something he can climb out of.
Lieutenant Veronica Colbath is a spokeswoman with the Coast Guard in Alaska. She says there's still some investigation ongoing and confirms that administrative sanctions are still possible. And she says the charges were dismissed without prejudice, which means if new information comes to light, they could be reinstated. She said more information on the investigation is likely due out in the next couple weeks. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
The U.S. Forest Service will be taking a second look this spring at the effects of logging on deer habitat for 17 timber projects it's already approved on the Tongass. The re-evaluation is a result of a court ruling that addressed just 4 Tongass logging plans, but the federal agency has agreed with litigants that 13 other projects also need more consideration. Joe Vicnicki reports.
The projects were approved between 1996 and 2007. They're located around Prince of Wales Island, as well as on the Ketchikan, Wrangell, Petersburg, and Juneau Ranger districts. In a lawsuit over 4 of the projects last August, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that the Forest Service needed to better explain its analysis of deer habitat. That ruling covered the Scott Peak and Overlook projects near Petersburg, along with Traders Cove near Ketchikan and the Sodanik project near Craig. Larry Edwards is a forest campaigner for Greenpeace in Sitka, one of the litigants in the suit.
We wrote the Forest Service after that decision was made and informed the Forest Service that there were a number of other timber projects that had the same problems with the deer modeling as those four, and that those should be reanalyzed under the court order as well. And the Forest Service has just told us that, yes, they agree they do need to go ahead and reanalyze those other projects.
The Forest Service is required by the National Environmental Policy Act, called NEPA, to publish anticipated impacts on national forest land from logging. The agency uses a mathematical model to assess different areas of the forest and how many deer the forest land can sustain. That deer model takes into account things like elevation, tree cover, and other factors that can make it easier or more difficult for the animals to survive a snowy winter. The Forest Service changed its methods for estimating deer habitat after these projects had been approved. Greenpeace and Cascadia Wildlands challenged the four timber projects and the agency's approval of them using the old deer model. The groups argue that the agency has been overestimating good deer habitat and underestimating the impacts of timber harvest in the project planning. Edwards expects that will show up in this reanalysis.
We do have results from modeling that was done for the 2008 forest plan for the wildlife analysis areas for each of these projects. And the results from that modeling shows far lower deer carrying capacities than was done in the original modeling for these projects. So we expect that there will be a need to supplement these NEPA documents, NEPA documents being environmental impact statements and environmental assessments.
Edwards says his group is happy the Forest Service has agreed to do the additional analysis. The agency has already sold some of the timber. Some of it's already been logged, and other sales are under contract with logging companies and slated for harvest. Edwards estimates the projects cover a total of about 200 million board feet. Annual harvests on the Tongass in the past decade have ranged from one quarter to one eighth of that amount. Tongass Forest Supervisor Forrest Cole sent a letter to Edwards in February outlining the agency's plan for taking another look at the projects in two phases. First up will be timber that's already been sold, along with sales that the agency hopes to offer this year, and the four projects covered in the court ruling. The agency says it does not currently have plans to offer timber from seven of the projects, but will do reanalysis for those when it does.
We're not anticipating that this work is going to have a significant effect on our current timber sale program on the Tongass.
That's Ted Shank. He's a staff officer for wildlife, subsistence, and planning on the Tongass. He says the review work is already underway. An agency team is looking systematically at the timber projects and their completed environmental documents for the individual projects. Shank says the work involves comparing geographic information system data before and after logging and what that means for deer habitat.
Then when we get the computer outputs in terms of number of deer per square mile at different time periods, and we'll be looking at probably 1954, somewhere around when the NEPA was done, and then after treatment to see what kind of changes there would be in the capability of the landscape to support deer at those different dates. And then we would compare that to what we had done in the original documentation.
Analysis for the first group of projects could be done by late July or early August. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicknicki.
Sport anglers will not get to fish for king salmon in the Taku River, and personal use fishermen won't be able to use dip nets or have a longer sockeye season. The State Board of Fisheries rejected several requests to change Taku River fishing during its meeting last week in Ketchikan. The salmon-rich waterway east of Juneau runs from British Columbia to Taku Inlet. The sport Chinook fishery was proposed by the Taku Users Group, representing riverbank cabin owners. Fish and Game Department staff warned it could violate an international agreement governing fisheries from Oregon to Alaska. Juneau board member Bill Brown spoke in opposition.
It flies in the face of the history we have about freshwater salmon fishing. And also, we have the problem with treaty fish, and that's an ugly nightmare we don't want to open yet again.
Some of the same objections came up with other proposals from the Taku Users Group. One would have extended the personal use fishery from mid-June through August to coincide with a gillnet opening. Another would have increased the household bag limit based on the number of family members. Yet another would have allowed personal use dip nets in the river, which Juneau residents access by boat. Talkeetna board member Tom Kluberton said it would be popular.
I think we would unleash a tremendous dip net fishery from boats down that way, which would offer much more opportunity to go and try for this harvest.
But other concerns, including salmon treaty implications, led the board to vote the proposal down. It also rejected an Alaska Trollers Association plan to increase access to Taku River Kings. Trollers proposed lengthening openings and changing how they are determined. Now they're tied to the gillnet fishery, which has a larger harvest. Kodiak board member Sue Jeffrey said she understands trollers want an equitable share, but she said the plan would create more conflicts.
This is an area where we should just back off for now and let the rebuilding continue. So I'm leaning away from supporting this.
Like other Taku River proposals, it failed on a unanimous vote. Three Washington State residents are being held in Ketchikan on charges of drug misconduct. 44-year-old Daniel Kenneth Gerbich, 31-year-old Misty Michelle Stefanik, and 46-year-old Scott David Farabee were arrested at Ketchikan's ferry terminal Sunday. All are from Puyallup. Ketchikan Police Lieutenant Joe White says officers executed a search warrant and found Gerbich carrying 3.5 ounces of methamphetamine, which has a street value of about $50,000. Officers also found a scale and plastic sandwich bags. Police say methamphetamine sells for as much as $500 per gram in Ketchikan, and an ounce yields 28 grams. Zone weather forecast today calls for rain, highs around 41. You're listening to Raven Radio, KCAW, in Sitka.